This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The United States leads the world in producing prisoners, with 2.3 million Americans behind bars. China, with four times the U.S. population, is a distant second, with 1.6 million people imprisoned. The United States' high rate of incarceration is one of several unique features of the American legal system, described in a series of articles by our guest, New York Times national legal correspondent Adam Liptek. Liptek is a Yale law graduate who had a legal career before becoming a full-time journalist. In fact, he worked as an attorney for The Times before becoming its legal correspondent in 2002. Soon he'll take over coverage of the U.S. Supreme Court with the retirement of veteran Times writer Linda Greenhouse. Well, Adam Liptek, welcome back to Fresh Air. You did this series recently about ways in which the American legal system is unique. And one of them involved imprisonment. What's the scale of incarceration in the United States as compared to other countries?
We have more prisoners than any other nation in the world. We're hardly the world's most populous nation. We have only 5% of the world's population. But we have almost a quarter of its prisoners. We have more prisoners in absolute numbers. And we have more prisoners also as a percentage of the population. So we're actually way off the charts.
How long has this been the case?
It's a relatively recent phenomenon. We've had decent records since about the 1920s, and from the 1920s to the 1970s, the American incarceration rate was a little bit higher than the rest of the world, but not very much, and quite stable. And then in the late 70s, as we started to get tough on crime, and as we started to have a serious crime wave, it shot way up. And there seemed to be a bunch of reasons for this. Part of it is that the American society is a more violent one, and particularly the murder rate, although it's fallen in recent years, is still maybe four times that of many European countries. We're also just much more punitive. We put more people in prison for relatively minor crimes, nonviolent crimes, property crimes, passing bad checks, and we put them in prison for longer than other parts of the world. And as a consequence, we recently passed an interesting milestone that more than one in 100 American adults is in prison today.
Okay, let's look at a couple of those potential explanations in a little more detail. It's clear that we have higher murder rates. We have a lot more handguns in use than a lot of countries. Do we have higher rates of crime generally or violent crime than, say, European countries?
I'm told that your likelihood of being assaulted in London and New York are about the same. But the murder rate in the U.S. is much, much higher. On the other hand, burglaries, robberies, things like that, the U.S. is relatively safe. So you really have to look at the kind of crime, and it's murder that's the outlier.
Uh-huh. You know, a number of things can affect how many people are in prison at a given moment. One of them is the rates of arrest and the extent to which people are incarcerated. One of the other things is how long they are kept there. Do we arrest people more frequently, or do we keep them in jail longer, or both?
Both of those things. We have, and there's another factor, Dave, to think about, which is we also define more things as crimes and more things as serious crimes. Possessing drugs in the U.S. Is very often thought to be a very serious crime. We have almost 500,000 people in prison for various kinds of drug crimes. In much of the rest of the world, the approach to drug abuse is counseling, rehabilitation programs. In the U.S., it's very often imprisonment.
And so the war on drugs is – I mean, you mentioned that our imprisonment rate rose sharply in the 70s. Does that roughly correspond to a preoccupation with drugs on the part of law enforcement?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. In 1980, we had maybe 40,000 people in prison for drug crimes. These days, about 500,000. So you see a very sharp spike in that.
Now, do criminologists believe that all of this incarceration has made us any safer?
Most people believe, and common sense would suggest, that incarcerating people drives down crime. You first of all take a potential criminal off the streets so that he or she is not likely to commit more crime, certainly not on the outside. And you also scare people. There's a deterrent effect. Some criminals are rational, and if you're going to be punished very severely for a conduct, you're less likely to commit it. So that there is a role, there's a connection between incarceration and driving down crime rates seems to me all but indisputable. But the question is how much and is it worth it? Most people say that other things like demographics, economic conditions, social safety net, policing strategies play as big or bigger a role. And you have to wonder also, even if you do get some marginal effect, even if you do drive down the crime rate some through massive incarceration, is that a societal bargain that we want to make? And those are hard questions.
You know, one of the other things that I wonder if it if affects the rate of incarceration in the United States is the fact that we elect a lot of our judges in many, many states. Does that matter?
Yeah, Dave, you mentioned that this is part of a series on ways in which U.S. law is different from the rest of the world, and that's another way in which we're different from the rest of the world. With the exception of scattered instances in Switzerland and Japan, we are the only country in the world that elects our judges. And once you have elected judges, they're going to be responsive to popular sentiment about crime, and that is typically to be tough, tough, tough on criminals. So you get this sort of feedback loop where you don't want to be that judge against whom, because he's elected or she's elected, a campaign commercial is run saying that Judge so-and-so let a criminal out and that criminal committed another crime. And that risk, that terrible risk to the judge's career, might incline them to be tough across the board.
You know, there's also the critique that American prisons, perhaps because they are so overcrowded and perhaps because they are expensive to run, tend to skimp on education and rehabilitation services, which would allow criminals to go in a different direction once they've gotten out. I mean, I'm wondering, do European countries look at that differently? Do prisons do a better job of giving people a different start in life?
Mm-hmm. I think, first of all, Dave, you're putting it mildly that the American prison system skimps. These days, the American prison system is geared almost only at punishment. Programs have been cut because they're expensive. Rehabilitation does not seem to be a goal, and it's at least arguable that prisons produce criminals. The model elsewhere in the world, and you know, it's hard to say that every place else is – I mean, there are variations all around the world. But the model elsewhere in the world is to try to figure out a way to bring people back into society, not to sort of cut them off forever. In the U.S., and people think – that there is a dividing line. If you do something bad enough, we sort of cast you out from society forever. We keep you in prison for a long time, then we let you out, but you're a convicted felon. You'll find it very hard to get a job. There are places perhaps that you're not allowed to live. There are states in which you're not allowed to vote. We have a very binary idea of who's a good person and who's a bad one, and I think other parts of the world think that's a more fluid thing.
Has it always been true that American prisons have completely neglected rehabilitation, or did we try and address this in past years?
In the 1800s, our penitentiary system was the model of the world. People came here to visit. De Tocqueville came here to visit to marvel at how we'd constructed a system in which people would be reformed and returned to society. And they would go back and write pamphlets and books about this fantastic American innovation of the penitentiary system, which was a model to the rest of the world. And we have gone from that to really the exact opposite. The rest of the world is no longer sending delegations to American prisons to learn how it might be done.
Let me just throw a couple of other legal ideas out here, which I know that you're familiar with. One is the broken windows theory of law enforcement, which was popularized in New York in the 1990s and has sort of swept through police departments around the country. And the notion being that if one aggressively pays attention to what some would regard as small crimes, I mean the street corner drug dealing or even the squeegee guy, that you create a sense of order and people are less likely to commit crimes if they know that people are really on top of them and they're going to be held accountable, and that you also find some bad actors who are out there violating parole and maybe having guns. And, of course, in New York City, that along with an increased police force and some other measures drove down crime dramatically in the 90s and has stayed down. How has that interacted with the demands on prison space? And does it argue for, in fact, a smart, aggressive kind of law enforcement?
I lived in New York through those years, and there's no question that the New York City of today, which is wonderful and safe, is very different from what we saw in the late 70s, early 80s. And there's no question that cracking down on turnstile jumping and people, you know, on very minor crimes must certainly have played a significant role on that. But that's mostly a story about policing. That doesn't tell you that the person you catch jumping a turnstile has to be sent to prison for 20 years. It's a story about let's get that guy, punish him appropriately, perhaps hold him overnight, perhaps write him a ticket. And if in the process you happen to catch, you know, a murderer, and sometimes, as you were suggesting, Dave, when you go after the small-time crime, you pick up in the net the big-time criminal as well. That's all a great idea, but that's a story about policing. That's not a story about the appropriate levels of punishment for given crimes.
One of the features of the American justice system, which you say is different, is the existence of the bail bondsman. And you write that the bail bondsman is an insurance salesman, a social worker, a lightly regulated law enforcement agent, a real estate appraiser, and a for-profit wing of the American justice system. Most of us don't deal with bail bondsmen much. Explain how the bail bond system works.
What a bail bondsman does is a private businessman is given the opportunity to get you out of jail in exchange for a non-refundable fee, typically 10% of the amount the judge set. And that sounds great. So, you know, you don't have the $1,000, but for $100, he'll come up with bail for you and you'll get out pending trial. But think about that for a second. You have someone who is presumed innocent, has not been convicted of anything, and we're going to hold him unless he pays a non-refundable fee to a private business. And we outsource to this private businessman both the question of should someone presumed innocent get out or not, and then allow him to make a profit on that person's freedom. And many, many people, although initially charged, are ultimately not convicted. So we not only have someone presumed innocent, but someone adjudicated innocent. And nonetheless, we've made that person pay a fee in order to retain their freedom.
And the reason the court system does it is that it appears to assure people are more likely to come back for trial? I mean, does it?
The numbers suggest it, although it's a little hard to control for it. Yes, it is true that bail bondsmen have an economic incentive to make sure that people show up for trial. They also have an economic incentive to choose only those people who are likely to show up for trial to begin with. So it's not as though we live in a world of bounty hunters. 99% of people would show up regardless. But it is also true that the 1% who goes on the lam, bail bondsmen, because they're on the hook for the whole amount, will aggressively try to get those people, probably more aggressively than systems in which the government handles this whole business.
And that's where it gets weird. I mean, we've empowered private citizens to arm themselves and go after criminals and lock them up. And what powers do they have? Can they handcuff somebody to a hotel bed and transport them across state lines? Things like that.
It's extraordinary. They can cross state lines. They can bust down the door of a private house. They can imprison that person. The theory behind it is that if you enter into this bail bond relationship with somebody and you sign a contract, you are their prisoner, and they can on a whim revoke your bail at any time. Snatch you up and take you back. This truly is a sort of frontier Wild West legacy of Americana that is retained in almost every state still.
Well, okay. So how do other countries handle this, and are they less likely to get defendants back for court appearances?
They handle it in lots of ways. Some countries don't let you out. They lock you up pretrial. Some countries let you out, but they make it a crime for you not to come back. So they'll prosecute you for that second crime. Some countries will take a deposit from you and give it back to you if you show up. Some countries will write down a number on a piece of paper, and if you don't show up, they'll make you liable for it, and they'll try to collect it from you later. So there are lots and lots of different ways to do it. But except for the Philippines, the U.S. is the only one that turns it into a commercial business.
We're speaking with Adam Liptak. He is the national legal correspondent for The New York Times. Another thing that you've written about, which is a distinct feature of the American legal system as opposed to other countries, is punitive damages, the idea that a jury, when listening to a civil dispute, can decide to order compensation not simply for one's injuries and costs, but for the punitive effect of punishing them and preventing this kind of future behavior in others. This isn't done elsewhere. And you illustrate this with an interesting case involving an Italian manufacturer, I think, of a motorcycle helmet, right? Explain what happened.
Yes. Just to put this in context for just a second, we've been talking mostly about criminal cases so far. We're now moving to civil cases. These are cases where people sue each other for money. I think I've been hurt in some way, and I sue someone else for money. And I say I would like not only to be made whole for the injury I've suffered, I also think that you, the defendant, should separately, even after I've been made whole, be punished because you did something really bad. And it's that punishment that we call punitive damages, and that in most of the rest of the world is viewed with disfavor because punishment, they think, is not to be done in these civil settings, but in criminal settings. Let prosecutors do the punishing and let civil cases be about making people whole. The Italian case you mentioned involved an Alabama court case where a young man falls off his motorcycle and his motorcycle helmet fails and he dies. The buckle snaps and his head, bare head, hits the pavement. He dies. His mom sues and a judge awards $1 million. He doesn't say how much of that is for compensatory damages to make her whole for her loss, how much for punitive, but it's clear that part is for each. The defendant is an Italian company. It has no assets in the United States. It refuses to pay. Her lawyers go over to Italy and say, I've got this Alabama court judgment. Please enforce it. That's usually a routine thing. Courts around the world, ours and others, if someone has a valid court judgment, they don't look behind it. They don't ask questions. They say, okay, we will now enforce that and you can collect your $1 million here in Italy. The Italian Supreme Court said, wait a second. We don't believe in punitive damages. We think that's a pernicious, bad idea to let the civil justice system go around punishing people. And as a consequence, I'm sorry, mom of the poor kid who died. We're not going to give you any money. And that phenomenon we've seen elsewhere in the world. The German Supreme Court did something similar. And the idea that American juries are awarding $1 million is not that much money, but sometimes enormous sums of money against Exxon. In the Exxon Valdez case, initially $5 billion. That idea, the rest of the world doesn't stomach. They think that prosecutors should be punishing, regulators should be regulating industries, and we shouldn't let 12 people in Alabama decide what is and is not good economic or social policy.
Now, I guess, but the other part of it, of course, is that a lot of the awards in civil cases are not for punitive damages. They're for actual losses. And in this case, you know, a young man died. But let's say he'd suffered serious injuries that required, you know, sustained medical care and rehabilitation all his life. Now, would an Italian court say, fair enough, if the manufacturer was liable, you do have to pay the real costs that this injury has suffered, but we're
Nobody disputes that.
Right.
Everywhere in the world, in the civil justice system, everyone agrees that the basic point of the lawsuit is to make you whole, to compensate you for your injuries. And the part of it that's in dispute is should you also, in that setting, go ahead and punish a defendant for doing something exceptionally bad.
You know, the notion here, I guess, is that plaintiffs and juries act as regulators of misconduct, including government and corporate misconduct at times by setting limits and imposing consequences that government regulators are either too busy or too overworked or too indifferent to do themselves. Explore that notion a little bit.
We trust ordinary people, and that's a wonderful aspect of the American justice system. We empower juries in many settings that the rest of the world doesn't trust ordinary people, would rather trust party functionaries in some part of the world or bureaucrats in others. We trust ordinary people to make judgments. But you do want to ask the question sometimes about whether 12 people with no special training should be making a decision, say, about whether a car's gas tank was properly constructed and whether a car company should have to pay $100 million to make sure that next time they construct that gas tank better, or whether we should leave it to government regulators. The counterargument is that regulators are sometimes lazy or in a way captured by the industries that they regulate, and it's hard to know what the right answer there is.
You know, I thought we'd talk about one more of the exceptions that you write about, and that involves the juvenile life sentence. Kids under 18 who commit awful crimes and are put in jail for life without parole. This is utterly unique.
We are literally alone in the world in doing this. No other nation in the world thinks it's a good idea to send, say, a 13 or 14-year-old who, without question, did something horrible, away to prison for the rest of his or her life without even the possibility of parole. The important point to pause on is that life sentences, although there too we are a very big user of life sentences, but with the possibility of parole is one kind of thing. The idea that you can make a decision about somebody who's done something terrible at 13 or 14, that by the time they're 40 or 50 or 60, they will remain beyond redemption, that there's nothing they could say about themselves to anyone that would let you reopen the book and say, you know what, let's take a fresh look. Maybe we let you out, maybe we don't, but at least we'll listen to you. That notion is literally unique to the United States.
Of course, that imperative for punishment is often driven by the horror of some crimes that young people commit. And this is illustrated, I think, so well about this case that you write about involving a young woman named Ashley Jones. Describe her crime and her situation.
Oh, Ashley Jones was a troubled child, and she was sent to live with her very tough grandfather. And she and her boyfriend got it into their heads that they were going to kill the grandfather, and they did. And they killed an aunt. They tried to kill a 10-year-old girl. And they very nearly succeeded in killing the grandmother as well. And Ashley Jones, as a consequence, was sentenced, I think at age 14, to life without parole in Alabama. I interviewed the grandmother, who had been in a coma for 30 days after being burned in the process of being stabbed. And she said that she lost dear members of her family and that this was very hard to forgive, but that Ashley was a child, and that there might come a time, she suggested 15, 20 years, when the authorities should have a fresh look at whether she had matured in some way that would allow this to be put behind her. The prosecutor, though, said to me, and that's, here's the other point of view, that there are some people who are born without a conscience, who are beyond redemption, and who should never be let out no matter what.
And how have appeals courts and the Supreme Court dealt with this? Because you can certainly imagine compelling arguments on both sides of this.
All of this life without parole stuff happens in the shadow of the death penalty. So the people who try to do away with the death penalty are very often big proponents of life without parole. The courts really haven't dealt with life without parole, and when they have, they haven't had a problem with it. But there was some reasoning in the Supreme Court's decision striking down the death penalty for people who committed crimes when they were under 18 that would suggest that some of that reasoning might someday be incorporated by some court to question whether life without parole for people who committed offenses at very young ages might be appropriate. The court said that young teenagers are subject to peer pressure, are rash, are capable of change, and that reasoning, while applied by the Supreme Court only to the juvenile death penalty, might also, by its logic, someday be applied to juvenile life without parole.
You know, Adam Lipsack, you have an interesting bio for a newspaper guy. I mean, I know you've been around the newspaper business for a long time. Were a copy boy when you were young, is that right?
That's right. Many years ago at the New York Times, I was fetching coffee for some of the people I work with today.
But you really have spent most of your career as a lawyer, including a number of years as a lawyer for the New York Times. And then in 2002, you became a staff writer covering legal issues. And I'm wondering, were there things about reporting that surprised you, misconceptions about how journalism works or new skills you had to develop? What was it like to leap into this business that you knew so well but hadn't practiced?
It was terrifying. It was my first 6 months were sheer terror. I really didn't have the background to be any kind of newspaper reporter, much less one starting on the national desk of the New York Times. I didn't have any sources. I had not really conducted telephone interviews. There's a skill set involved in journalism, which is not the hardest thing in the world to master, but really you want to do it on your college paper and maybe at some regional paper and not in the big time. So I remember being assigned a story saying, Adam, we need 700 words on this and so, and not knowing how much reporting it takes to fill up 700 words, or when to stop answering the phone to make sure I would finish by deadline, or how long 700 words really was. I'd be hitting the little button to see the word count. And one afternoon, I remember I got up to 550 words, and I had nothing more to say. I go, oh, my God, what do you do now? All of that, those are not the hardest skills to master. And I think I did master those at least. Then I did get to know some people, and now I have trustworthy people I know in many, many legal subject matter areas that I can call to get a gut check on whether a development is important, how it's important, how it's different from the past. I had none of that. So the early days were challenging.
Well, Adam Liptak, thanks so much for speaking with us, and good luck with the Supreme Court.
Oh, thank you so much.
Adam Liptak is the New York Times national legal correspondent. The first family of surfing is how the Paskowitzes were described in the New York Times. It's a family with several championship surfers, a family that founded a now-famous surfing school in California. But surfing may be the least part of what makes this family atypical. The Paskowitz family is the subject of a new documentary which opens in New York this week. A few days ago, Terry Gross spoke with John Paskowitz about his childhood and about his father, Dorian.
Dorian Paskowitz, or Doc as he's known, was a Stanford-educated, twice-divorced physician living in Hawaii in the mid-1950s when he decided to give up his conventional life and devote it to surfing. He went to Israel for a year and introduced surfing there. Then he moved back to the U.S., married, and had 9 children, 8 boys and a girl. He had a dream of a utopian family life devoted to surfing and fostering mental and physical health by living as naturally as possible, outside of society's rigid structures. No rent, no house, no job, a strict diet, no schools for the kids. The 2 parents and 9 children lived in a 24-foot camper and drove where the spirit moved them. The new documentary about the Paskowitz family, called Surfwise, is about Doc's dream and the realities it created for his family. For 10 years, his wife was pregnant or breastfeeding without one day off. He wanted his family to live like animals in the natural world.
When my wife had my first baby, I said, look, I don't want any gorilla to do anything with its baby that you don't do with my baby. If a gorilla feeds its baby for 2 years, I want you to feed my baby at the breast for 2 years. I don't want to be upstaged by any gorilla or any chimpanzee or any newt or any gecko or any squirrel.
As you can imagine, Doc's dream had its consequences.
My dad always wanted us to understand that we were no different from the great apes, which was fine if we had stayed there, but we didn't stay there. We got married, and our wives didn't want to be married to an animal. Yeah. So, it's hard to deal with modern life sometimes still.
Doc's dream included homeschooling his children.
I wasn't some kind of avant-garde, radical, intellectual. I just wanted my kids around me, surfing with me, and education be damned.
It may have seemed like freedom at the time, but some of Doc's children now regret being kept out of school.
My dad always loves to show off the fact that he's a Stanford graduate, and it's like, what the heck kind of Stanford graduate, what the heck kind of Jew would say, I'm not sending my kids to school? I think that was completely unfair. If you were going to keep us in the camper for the rest of our lives, then that was okay. But you can't keep us uneducated and then send us off into the world and expect that there's not going to be some serious problems,
The film Surfwise was directed by Doug Prey. My guest, John Paskowitz, is one of Doc's 9 children. He won the U.S. and World Longboard Championships in the late 1980s. He's worked on surf comics, surfer gear, and surf-related movies. He's a producer of Surfwise. I asked him about living with his 8 siblings and 2 parents in that 24-foot camper. Where did they all sleep?
We slept everywhere. We made makeshift places to sleep. We made hammocks. We slept on the floor. We slept with each other. It was wonderful. There's nothing better than cuddling your brothers and lying around, one brother reading a comic book to the others or a book that's very exciting all of the things that are almost Little House on the Prairie-ish, if you remember that. Were happening organically with us, reading and talking and and games that we played that interacted with our surroundings and stuff like that. It was all very wholesome and fun, and I don't think we ever thought of the camper as cramped. It's not till later that we look in hindsight at where we were and how we lived that the concept even of being crushed into the little camper came out. We didn't come up with it. Somebody on a INLA show or something that interviewed us said that. And then later we went, whoa, all of us living in a 24-foot camper, I guess that was hard. But back then, we didn't see it as hard.
It seems like your father really sought freedom for himself, but he was quite the disciplinarian with the children. What were his techniques for keeping discipline and for punishing the kids when he felt they were out of line?
There wasn't a lot of corporal punishment. Most of it was verbal, to just explain things to you. And then, of course, a physical quest, walking someplace or paddling your surfboard a certain distance or running to a certain location within his point of view and back within a time frame. As a little sidebar, when we were working for my dad would get Option magazine and go and be a doctor in places where they really needed a physician and make a little money, and then would go, you know, off on a quest afterwards. And one time we went to Block Island, Rhode Island, and we got to this place, and the schoolhouse that he let us go to for the time we were there had breakfast for the kids. And I sat down and consumed 72 boxes of Kellogg's Frosted Flakes.
In one day?
In a row.
Holy cow.
In a row, without pausing.
Because you were so deprived of sugar. I mean, you weren't allowed to have any sugar.
I got so systematic opening the boxes. I actually, like, made a soundtrack to the slice, slice, open, open, bam, bam, milk. And 72 boxes later, the lady from the class that I was in calls the superintendent or the principal and says, this poor little boy, he just ate 72 boxes of Kellogg's. We need to talk to their parents. Maybe they're starving these kids. So my dad was brought into the loop, and he explained that we were not permitted sugar at home, and that's probably what it was. And when I got home, he didn't punish me at all, and I was going, huh, I wonder what's going to happen. And later that night, he woke me up at about 3-4 o'clock in the morning, and he wanted me to walk quite a distance in the snow and the cold down in total jet black darkness to a place at the harbor, which we particularly found scary, and make a mark to prove that I'd been there and then come back to show me, you know, what the effects of all of that sugar had done to my ability to process a goal and go on a mission. And it was definitely, I felt it. I definitely felt it. And I was scared, and it was a long, hard quest, and I fell into a lake, and it was just, it was scary. And it taught me a good lesson.
Which was what?
Which was everything in moderation. I mean, you can take cyanide in moderation.
But your father didn't do things in moderation. He was extreme.
In the sense that you're looking at it from a social point of view, he was extreme. But from the point of view that he liked to emulate, which was living extremely fit and Spartan in your existence, to be as fit and effective in everything that you do as possible. And that requires a certain amount of strictness. One, because you're living in a society where you can go into a store and just walk down the aisles and be a hunter, gatherer, farmer, all the things that, you know, took a lifetime for humans to achieve at once. You can consume massive quantities of food and really hurt yourself. And number two, if he didn't have the strictness, you would not have been able to keep the herding of the Pasquitz children together, because, like Joshua says, it's like herding cats, you know, keeping us together. And if there wasn't some type of framework of strictness, there were times that we probably wouldn't have survived. I mean, because he took us on bold quests and big surf and wild adventures. And when you were doing that, you have to behave. In some order.
You know, you were all homeschooled. You were never, at least not for any extended period of time, within the school system. And part of what your father schooled you in was surfing. Did you love surfing as much as he wanted you to?
That's a good question. Only once have I heard any of the brothers say that they did not love surfing. And that was after Moses' accident, and he was basically eviscerated by a surfboard fin at the water's edge and had to wear a colostomy for a year, and it was a terrible accident. And afterwards, when he was recovering, he said, "I'll never surf again. I hate surfing." And he, after he did, lose the colostomy and come back to full health, thank God, he took it back. But for me personally, words cannot describe the euphoria that surfing provides as a human. Words cannot describe the absolutely magical and romantic feeling of riding a wave, going up and down on the surface of the water, and feeling just an unlimited power under your feet, and to be in harmony with the ocean, perhaps riding along and seeing a dolphin in the face of the wave next to you, or a beautiful rainbow as the spray of the wind is offshore pluming over the back of the wave. And it's just the most beautiful, romantic, organic thing I think a human can do.
John, you've done very well professionally. You've been the head of companies and marketing, and it seems like most, if not all, of your siblings have done well. Mm-hmm. You were homeschooled by your parents, who I think by anybody's standards you'd have to say they were a little eccentric. So what was homeschooling like? Like, did you learn, in addition to learning about surfing, did you learn about literature or science and medicine? Your father's a doctor. Did you learn about math, history? Like, what was the process of the homeschooling? What kind of books did you have around?
My mother and father always had a pretty wide array of books. I think our family favorite had to be the dictionary. We would sit down and somebody would say a word and then, read it out of the dictionary, and you had to give us a definition or use it in the form of a sentence. That was probably one of the funnest games. I hate to say this, but we fleeced so many libraries growing up. We tried to get the books back if we were staying in a place long enough to do that. But he would give us the information, we would read it. If you asked him why the sky was blue, he would give you a book on light. And usually the more like the college version of something. And we loved to read his medical books, and he loved to talk about family lineage and history. And he always promoted us knowing more about our family's mother side. And also my mom brought a huge aspect into it through music, through classical music, and her explanation of the stories behind some of the classical operas and arias that she had learned. And she had a tremendous voice, and she would, sing stories to us and such. But there are big holes where you didn't get everything because...
an example of that?
Well, I didn't pay much attention to math. But I loved reading, and I loved music, and I loved philosophy, and I loved poetry, and I loved... So it was really sharing information and interfacing with each other pretty much off the hip. There was very, very little structure.
We talked a little bit about diet in your family. Your father was opposed to sugar of any sort, and you you told us a story about eating 72 mini boxes of Frosted Flakes the first time you were exposed to them. So what was the typical diet like? Because the family didn't have money either. So they had these strict dietary prohibitions and no money. So what did you typically have for breakfast and dinner?
Most always for breakfast was seven-grain cereal. And my father used to go to a place in Escondido that cut rough grains. And my brothers always said it was bird seed, and it did look like bird seed. It was flax and various cut grains in big bags. Or there's an oro wheat product called seven-grain cereal that we would get if we couldn't find that original kind of it looks like horse feed. In fact, it might have been horse feed because there was, like Moses says, sometimes there were sticks and twigs and branches in it sometimes. And there were. And we'd boil that up like a gruel, a big pot of gruel. And we'd sing food, glorious food, and my mom would dole it out for us in the morning. And if we were really lucky, we could have a tablespoon of corn oil on it. and we might have a banana or a piece of fruit with that if we were lucky. And then usually beans and rice would be the typical lunch and dinner, maybe a soup. My mom's excellent soup and beans and rice maker. And then we were allowed to have any kind of chili peppers or anything spicy, you know, we wanted with that. And that would be probably be it. You know, if we were lucky, we could have fruit, oddly, in the middle of the day or something like that. But it was a lot of the gruel, a lot of beans and rice. And if we were rolling, we'd have maybe eggs for breakfast or with our gruel or maybe a chicken dinner on the Sabbath.
And what would happen when you were exposed, like say you saw somebody's television or you went to town and you saw things you wanted? Kids are always doing, I want. You know, mm-hmm. I want this, I want that. I saw it at commercial. I saw it in the supermarket. I saw it in the toy store.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go through I wants? And what were the things you wanted that you couldn't have?
And before we were exposed, there were no such thing as I wants. It was more like, what can I do for you, Mom? Or what can I do for your dad? I know that sounds ridiculously civil, but we were always anxious to do something, work on the car, paint this, fix that, create a better way of tying on the boards, a better way of dealing with the blivet bags, whatever it was. And then once we got old enough to like have sleepovers or see somebody's house and actually see towels with their names on it and like kids that had their own section in the refrigerator with Twinkies and Ho-Hos, and it was unbelievable to us. It was beyond our comprehension. And that's when we all realized we wanted sugar, we wanted fat, we wanted salt, we wanted TV, we wanted to play with little girls, we wanted to, you know, we wanted all of those things.
And what did your parents tell you about why you couldn't have it?
It wasn't so much we couldn't have it as we didn't need it. It wasn't that we didn't want it.
They told you didn't need it.
Yeah, and we really didn't. In fact, it was pretty obvious to us when we first started like having like sprees of sugar consumption or sprees of burgers or whatever it was that we, you know, would get a couple bucks. Somebody would give us a tip for taking them surfing or something, and you'd run up and buy like 4 hamburgers or 5 hamburgers and eat them all in a sitting. I remember like Abe ate 2 dozen eggs one time, just hard-boiled 2 dozen eggs and ate them, like Cool Hand Luke. And we were like, hey. He had an anaphylactic reaction, and we were just like, "What? Why would you do that?" And he goes, "When we would always have eggs, I never got my share of the eggs. I don't know why, but Mom always passed me by with the eggs, and I just had a buck in my pocket or whatever. I went and bought 2 dozen eggs and boiled them and ate them to fill his egg need."
When you and your siblings left the family, were you still having problems learning about moderation once you were in the world and you were exposed to things that you can do in excess and you have to be careful about?
Absolutely. Moses, you know, is always worried about his weight and Nava and...
Your sister.
My sister Nava and the rest of us all are support group for each other pretty much because nobody understands us like ourselves. We're all fighting with that. I'm very excited to get the chance to rebuild myself after this and try another poke at being a person.
What do you mean by that? Try another poke at being a person?
Oh, just that, you know, the Pasquitzes have ephemeral lives. They go and they grow and they do something, and sometimes they don't always finish what they start, or they don't follow through with it. I mean, Moses and some of the brothers that have had 9-to-5 jobs that have maintained them for years and years, I really respect. But some of us, Abraham, myself, Joshua, Salvador, you know, we've tried and failed in many things, and each thing is a learning process, and each thing prepares us better for the next thing.
Are there any of your siblings who are following your father's dream and how they're living their lives or raising their families?
Everybody in their own way copies something. Adam really wants to follow the dream, only he wants to do it in a boat, not in a camper. David follows his dream in a different way by organizing himself now physically because he sees himself getting older and he wants the longevity. Abraham is more of the philosophical dad. Everyone's got their like pros and cons. You know, I do a lot of things like my father, and we are probably, my mom says, in some ways we're the closest to each other, but I have more vices than anybody in the family, I'm sure. You know, I think Adam would be the one that I would pick out as the one individual that really wants to make the quest in his life and take his kids on that quest too.
Surfer John Paskowitz speaking with Terry Gross. His family's story is told in the documentary Surfwise.